We're here this morning, it's Saturday of the Panama Canal reunion, and we're with Captain Wilder. And first of all, I want to thank you, Captain Wilder, for agreeing to be interviewed.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you taking your time out. I wonder if we could start, if you wouldn't mind telling me when and where your involvement with the Panama Canal and the Canal Zone first started.
Where do you want me to start?
Maybe when you first arrived, or did your parents have any involvement, or did it begin with your generation, or?
Well, I had been sailing the Faroe Lines for 8 years, and I was a skipper with Faroe Lines for about 5 years, from 1942, I guess it was, to 1950, 8 years. Five of those years as master of a ship going to, a few ships going to West Africa on a regular run, which was a requirement in the Panama Canal to become a pilot. You had to be have an unlimited license and then sail at least 1 year as master of an ocean-going ship. So I left Faroe Lines in 1950, and during the Korean War, went on active duty in the Navy as lieutenant commander and operations officer on a ship. And my twin brother, who had also sailed with Faroe Lines, had been master of roughly the same ships that I'd been master of. He was still sailing with Faroe Lines. He put an application in for the Panama Canal, because his mother says, the mother of his kids said, the children need a father. So I didn't go to sea for 3 months at a stretch. He put an application, and so did I. He happens to be my twin brother, so his name was Arthur, my name was Albert, and his application was accepted, and saw the ships that he'd been on as master, as well as chief and third mate, second mate, and so on. And then they got my application, and it was A. Wilder. And these are about the same ships that he had been master of, I had been master of. So they put mine in the round file. This is my, thought it was a duplicate.
Okay.
So they threw it away.
Oh, no.
But anyway, the Navy wouldn't release me until about 6 months later. And my brother said, you're going to reapply? I says, yeah, I will. So I did, and that's how I got the job. In October of 1952, I went down to Panama with my family.
Can you talk a little bit, Captain Wilder, about your earlier life? Did your parents' father have any involvement in the Navy, or was that something?
No, he was in the National Guard during the war, but he never got to go to sea and didn't go across. He stayed in the United States, but he was in the National Guard for a length of time during World War I. But that's as far as sea going is concerned. I think I had an Uncle Phineas who went to sea at one time, but that's about it. My brother and I, when we graduated from high school in Weymouth, Mass., we decided we didn't want to sit behind a desk. So actually, we went to sea first in 1936 as cadets for the Munson Line. I was when I was junior in high school, and went to South America and back as cadets. And then when we graduated from high school, we both went to Massachusetts. They called it the Massachusetts Nautical School. It was a three-masted bark, a sailing ship. We spent 2 years on that and got a third set before the local inspectors in 1939, and got a third mate's license, unlimited. And both of us shipped out as AB. In fact, we were on two ships, I think it was. We were both on the same ship. And it's always funny, I was on the 8 to 12 watch, and he relieved me at midnight, and the second mate was coming on watch. So after about 20 minutes, he looked around and says, "Didn't you get relieved yet?" And I said, "Oh yeah, I got, well, oh, that's right, you guys are twins." You couldn't tell.
You couldn't tell.
Yeah. While on the school ship, though, we got ashore and we made a voyage to Europe on this three-masted bark, the Nantucket. And we coaled, had an auxiliary engine coal burner, and we were coaling shipping in Norfolk. And come on in, coal and ship in Norfolk. So brother and I decided we'd go ashore and get tattooed. So we did. So we went to a fellow by the name of Coleman, was on East Main Street, tattoo artist. In fact, he has an exhibition in the Newport News Maritime whatever it is over there in Newport News. Anyway, we're looking for an anchor, and here's the anchor that he put on me. And
wow.
My brother got the same thing.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted to know if we wanted initials. We said, no, just the anchor.
Just the anchor.
And in those days, in 1938, what do you think that cost?
Oh. Can't even imagine. $10.
Yeah, 25 cents.
25 cents. Okay, I was off by a little bit. Wow.
50 cents with 50 cents with initials.
Okay. Wow, you went
that
for
time,
the
that time.
Went
you
for
get
the
a nickel beer, you know.
Yeah, shoot, that's great.
Anyway,
we had one. Yeah. Just
so again, we had a uniform similar to the one in the Navy. Navy enlisted man. And so we came back aboard ship, and of course the news had spread around the ship before we got there. Oh, the twins got tattooed, now we can tell them apart. So the officer of the deck met us at the gangway and says, "I understand you two boys got tattooed." "Yep." "Let's see yours." "Hey, pretty good. Let's see yours."
The same, yeah.
So it didn't work.
Didn't work, yeah.
Anyway. That's part of the school ship that we had fun on. And being twins, of course, we didn't get hazed too much simply because they didn't know which one they were using to be hazed. So we didn't, the upperclassmen didn't bother us too much. We left the school ship in 39, graduated with third mate's licenses. But had to sail AB because there was no jobs as third mate, so we sailed.
Now, when you say sail AB?
Sail as a seaman.
Okay.
Yeah. An able seaman.
Uh-huh.
And we both were on the Beacon at one time for about 6 months, a tanker running from New York to Aruba and Boston and so on, coastwise mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And the foreign going to one of Trinidad or Aruba, one of the places.
Uh-huh.
But then he got, we both ended up on the Olga, and he got the third mate's job for a while, and I was boasting on it. And we made some short trips, a little coal boat running from New York to Norfolk or Virginia.
Uh-huh.
Either Newport News or the other place. Anyway, sometimes I, as bosun, sometimes I had him in a crew member, and sometimes he was on the bridge. So I always got it even with him when he was a crew member.
Yeah.
Anyway, I left there, and we both shipped out. Got time in. You had to sail at least a year on your license, so
mm-hmm.
We both finally had time enough for a second mate's license, which we sat in Boston. Before the local inspectors, he got a second mate license and went in 1942 and went second mate on the William Hooper, a Liberty ship. And I got one second mate on the Daniel Morgan. And we loaded, I made my ship in Wilmington. And we went to New York and loaded with airplanes and so on, and ammunition.
That was a Liberty ship?
Liberty
also.
Ship, yeah. Uh-huh. And he was in, I forgot what port he loaded, but anyway, we went into Halifax, Nova Scotia, waiting for a convoy. And who should come in the next day was William Hooper. So I waved him as he went by at the Anchorage and Basin, in the Bedford Basin. And then he took off for England, and I took off for Iceland. And we had a gun crew aboard. And we in fog, we put what they call a fog buoy streaming back aft, so that the ship astern, when you're in convoy, you could see the fog buoy shooting up a big plume of water. Mm-hmm. You couldn't see the ship, but you could see the plume of water. And this one day around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, there was fog set in over the ocean there. And we had a gun crew fog with a 3-inch .50 gun they had on the bow. And before the mate could stop, could shout that it was a fog buoy, they fired 2 shots, and one of them hit the fog buoy, which is darn good shooting. And of course, the commodore blinked over and said, "What's the problem?" And the gun crew commander blinked back, "We just shot the fog buoy at us." Well, he said, "Good shooting." So anyway, we got into Iceland and anchored just outside of Reykjavik. And who should come in the next day but the William Hooper.
Oh, wow.
So he anchored beyond us. And at that time, we had no walkie-talkies or anything. We did it mostly by signal light.
Yeah.
So I watched him see where he was anchored. So both he and I were standing on the 12 to 4 watch in the afternoon and in the morning. So around midnight, I'd get this long tube that had a sort of a trigger on the end of it and had a light in it. And I'd aim it at the William Hooper and send A's to alert my brother. And we'd talk back and forth.
Oh, wow.
On the watch. He's uh-huh. about half a mile away.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, we got underway finally. I think it was July 1st, somewhere there. And on the way to Russia, we got attacked by submarines. Forgot how many ships were sunk. We ran into fog. We had 26 ships, so it was more or less, along with the heaviest protected convoy that ever left Iceland, bound for Murmansk and Archangel. Mm-hmm. And we proceeded till July 4th when we got attacked by a squadron of torpedo planes. And we saw 2 torpedoes coming for my ship, our second mate. And skipper, he headed into the same course as the torpedoes were, and you could see him running down one side or the other.
Wow.
I looked over and I saw William Hooper. The William Hooper got hit right in the engine room. So I drifted back, so I said, "See, that's Hatch, my brother's ship." So we were July 4th in the afternoon. Word came from the British Admiralty, who was in charge of the convoy. The escort, which was about 15 naval ships, including an aircraft carrier, were to leave the convoy, and the convoy was to proceed its destination at its utmost speed. Well, a Liberty ship only does about 10 knots if he's loaded. So that's what happened. We separated. So we were attacked by two dive bombers, mm-hmm. a sole ship. The Fairfield City was one of the ships that was unarmed. We had a 3-inch .50 forward, a good air, an aircraft gun. Half we had a 4-inch, which is just surface, but is useless for airplanes. So we had this good gun crew forward that had shot that boy. So two dive bombers come in and drop three bombs apiece. And they drop it once and try to straddle the ship. And of course, the captain, as soon as he saw it, would zigzag. And they missed us. And I think we got one of those planes with the 3-inch .50
forward. Oh, wow.
And then about 2 hours later, here comes four dive bombers. And I think we got one out of that one, but all of the rest of them missed. And I think the last attack was about 3 hours later. It was daylight out there all the time.
Wow, yeah.
So about, I think it was about five of them came over. And the last one got a near miss back ass simply because when they tried to seat the shell into the 3-inch .50, the barrel was so hot, either the shell expanded or the barrel contracted or something. But anyway, it was short of going in to being set good by about 2 inches. So I went back aft to get a picture. I was a merchant crew, but we tried to help the gun crew.
Yeah.
I got a pitcher of cold water to pour down the barrel. Didn't work.
Yeah.
No. So the last guy got a near miss back aft and ruined the engine room and ruined the steering gear room.
Uh-huh.
And with no rudder, we were helpless.
Oh, no.
So word came to abandon ship. So we're still underway, you know, but she's not steering. So,
yeah.
The chief mate, he launched his boat before the order was given. He got kind of excited. He launched his boat and tried to get into it before it got into the water, and he was crushed against the side of the ship of the boat. So we lost that man. And then the one I was in charge of, my boat went down, but I wasn't in it. So I pulled a toggle on a life raft and jumped in the water after it. And that water was, the engine remote usually takes a water temperature every morning, every evening. And the water was 36 degrees.
Oh, wow.
And I was swimming in it.
Oh, man.
I practically walked to the raft from here to that plant over there with the water and got out of it and commandeered the lifeboats, got back in, and took over the steering oar, and there were about five seamen in the thing. So I said, okay, man, he was rowed back to the ship because the ship was still floating.
Yeah.
It lost weight. So we went alongside and I clambered aboard and went up to my room soaking wet. Took my clothes off and somebody said, okay, abandon ship again. I said, oh, God, here we go again. So I put on a pair of pants and shirt and so on.
Uh-huh.
And, got back into the lifeboat. And the captain had all his papers, his logbook and so on. He'd put in and wrapped a life jacket, a cork life jacket around it so that it wouldn't sink. And he'd thrown it over the side and we were gonna go pick it up. When all of a sudden, a torpedo hit the ship.
Oh.
Boom, and she went. I could see, I still see her. She just broke in half. She went this way, of course, she went down.
Oh.
And the old four inch gun fired as it short circuited the whatever it was
that
made the thing fire. She sunk. And the submarine come up. All the debris around there and so on. And, we had three lifeboats, one had a motor in it. And we were going to hook them up, which we did.
Yeah.
The third lifeboat was all holes from machine guns that fired at us on the attack from the torpedo planes. And but she was afloat. She wasn't sinking, which she had a lot of holes in it. But anyway, we got shot. We sat ahead and the submarine surfaced, and Captain came on the conning tower, and yelled over, Where's the captain of the ship? And Sullivan, who was my captain, he said, I'm the captain. What was the name of the ship? He says, the Daniel Morgan, Liberty ship. And he says, what was your cargo? And Sullivan says, hospital supplies, rubber tires. And some request, we wasn't laughing. We weren't laughing. And some skipper says, I don't believe you. Now what? You know. So someone quickly changed the subject. He says, our compasses aren't any good. Which is the direction to nearest land? Of course, he pointed to Norway, which was occupied by the Germans, you see. And so, thank you. So just follow me. He says, so of course we, Sullivan turned and towing two boats and the motor sailor, we started for the submarine. And he was, of course, speedier than we were. So suddenly, not suddenly, but eventually he was out of sight. So we were going to try to make Nova Zembla, which is an island there off the White Sea. It had been a couple of days sailing. But anyway, here comes a ship. Oh, hey. And by God, he's coming towards us. And it was a Russian tanker. So, he slowed down. We got aboard. He had a crew already that had been sunk off Hatteras. So now it's three crews for one set of lifeboats. So, oh man, we get sunk on this thing, we'll know it.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, we all got aboard. And of course, the captain and myself and the third mate went up to the bridge, and one of the ABs went up, communist, everybody's equal. And the old man said to the AB, he says, who are you? The Russian captain spoke good English. He says, who are you? I said, I'm one of the seamen. Get back after it's long. So there wasn't any socialists there, you know. So anyway, they had two 3-inch 50s, one forward and one aft. Well, our gun crew had been up since the first of July. Now this was the 5th. So they went forward. Ensign was in charge. And they had empty shells all around doing the convoy. I guess they'd been battling away, you know, shooting. So anyway, he had them clean up the place through the empty shells over the side and so on. He got the gun ready. Russians were, you know, non-competitive. They figured, well, we're close to Russia, no problem. And here comes two airplanes. And all of a sudden they start to dive.
German?
Yeah, German. And so, gun forward, pow, 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 fast as they could load that 3-inch 50 and fire at that thing. And they got one.
Wow.
So we're going, when we got aboard the ship, it was supposed to have been twin screw, we heard, rumors. Twin screw, and she was fast as the, she did 10 knots, the same speed as the Liberty ship, and she was loaded with molasses. Well, it wouldn't explode, you know, maybe, but it would sink.
Yeah.
So anyway, they missed us. 9 o'clock in the morning, that was. 9 o'clock in the evening, still daylight. Here comes two more. And we kept those up. I don't know if we got one of those or not. 9 o'clock was apparently their time, because 9 o'clock the next night, same thing. 9 o'clock in the morning, same thing. Two dive bombers come over, drop their load, and leave. Never hit us, but boy, they come close, you know. I remember Captain and I were standing up on the bridge, and if you could see the bombs coming, then they either go one side or the other. But if you couldn't see them, if you missed them, man, you can hear them coming, you know.
Yeah.
I looked over and poor old Sullivan missed seeing him this time, man, he's not like this. boom, they went. I says, missed. Oh, just God. So anyway, the old man, the skipper of the Russian Army, got aboard first. It says that Sullivan, oh, you know the place. You know, you take over. Captain Sullivan said, "No, no way. It's your ship. You handle it." And this guy was going to go straight, you know, without zigzagging. He zigzagged, of course, the planes couldn't get a good bearing on you, see. So, you know, so they decided to zigzag. That's what saved us too. Anyway, we picked up. I think it was 2 days. We picked up land and came into a nice sheltered basin. Harbor, dropped the anchor, daylight, of course. And everybody went to bed, including the lookout, the mate, the skipper, and everybody. 8 o'clock in the morning, the Captain Sullivan woke up. Gosh, nobody's around. Everybody's asleep. Oh, we're in Russia. I mean, why? Why bother? So we're getting underway, and here comes a four-motor job. Oh, that's Russian. The gun crew forward, we're not Russians, you know, they were Americans. As soon as that thing came close, they fired on it.
Is it an American plane?
And the plane veered off, and somehow or another you looked up and see crosses on the wings, not stars.
German,
yeah.
Oh, no.
That's something we're going to drop something on them, you know? But the Russians, oh, no, we're in Russia now, like hell.
Yeah.
So anyway, we got out of Russia.
What port was that, or what?
It was a small bay. I don't know what it was a port of. Nobody went ashore because we were going to get on the next day as soon as everybody got rested. I don't know which one it was, but anyway, we went into the White Sea and anchored in Archangel before docking. So they had two rescue ships in the convoy. One was the Rathlin, I forgot the other one, but anyway, the Rathlin anchored about half a mile away, or less, about a quarter of a mile. But you could loud hailing with a loud hailing, you could yell over. So once the Rathlin got anchored, Sullivan got hold of the loud hailer and yelled over, "If you got any survivors aboard?" And he says, "Yes, we got three ship survivors." Now there's three crews. The Rathlin was built to carry rescue sunken ships or the crew anyway. They wanted to have the crew of the William Hooper aboard. I said, "Yeah, we do. Have you got, is Mr. Wilder there?" I said, "Yeah, we'll tell him his brother's over here."
Wow.
That was good news.
That was good news.
So we got ashore in Archangel, and they told us to take our clothes off, and we'd laundered and put it. We only had one suit of clothes. We didn't put any suitcases in the lifeboat. So we threw them, gave them our clothes and so on. And they're going to wash them and iron them or whatever they did. Well, they gave us pajamas and we had cots. I think they put out. We went to the Inn Tourist Hotel. And they had cots out for us and so on. And 2 days later, here come the clothes. And they piled them in the corner about the height of that suitcase. Here are your clothes. Jesus Christ. I don't know if I got the same pants or not, but anyway, you went in and grabbed what you could.
You got some pants,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And my brother had been ashore. He got ashore before I did, so he went around to a store and picked up. Through high school, I played a guitar, he played a mandolin, and used to play at dances during the intermission at high school dances and so on. So he picked up a mandolin and I picked up a guitar. Oh, I didn't pick it up. The cadet aboard ship traded the captain's sweater for a guitar. So now we had, he had a mandolin, I had a guitar. So there were about five hospitals there. So we were in Russia for about 2 months. The interest, and we'd go every other day or so, we'd go to one of the hospitals and give them a song. And they sent a woman up from Moscow to teach us a couple of Russian songs, which she did. She said the words and I wrote it down the way it sounded, you know, and then we memorized them. And so we lived in Mexico at one time, 6 years, both of us, so we knew Spanish. And we had Cielito Lindo, El Rancho Grande, and a couple others that we sang to him. And I guess the people liked it. Most of the year, casualties were frostbite.
Wow.
And there was one poor cadet, British fella, he had his foot cut off. The Russians didn't bother trying to cure it. They just his frostbite, just cut it off. He didn't have a foot. And this one didn't have a leg from there down. Mm. He had, I think he had these two fingers left. And on the left hand, I think he had these two fingers. Mm-hmm. And he was only about 17 years old, poor kid. But he had good spirits. And I remember we were playing one time, and this poor guy came in who had lost his legs right there, both of them. And he yelled over. He was, of course, laying in his bunk, couldn't do much, but he yelled over. This cadet yelled over the guys, "Hey, why don't you get off your knees?" And he left, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, there was also a Cuban, and I played Spanish song. I think it was Rancho Grande or one of them. And he had both hands cut off. You could see tears coming because nobody spoke Spanish, you know, just Russian and so on. So he was incommunicado, you know, he couldn't talk to anybody or understand anybody when he heard the Spanish songs. It really brought him back.
Wow.
Well, anyway, first we were going to insist they fly us out of there. And after 2 weeks, we insisted that we go back on the Navy ships. And after about a month, we're going to find out how long it would take us to walk across Siberia. Oh, they did what they were going to do. They doubled us up on the ships going back.
Okay.
So we had...
how many ships did you lose on the convoy?
About 26.
26
out of 36.
Wow. So it was almost a disaster.
It was one of the worst convoys ever hit, PQ-17. They even wrote a book about it.
Yeah.
And... So what they did, they doubled us up on the ships going back. And some poor guys got sunk on the way up and sunk on the way back. They sunk four on the way back. But we had an escort finally on the way back, so it wasn't too bad. But it was still
Had most of the ships been sunk without the escort on the way over?
Yeah, well, the escort left us.
Yeah.
It says, scattering procedure, your utmost... Scatter and proceed at your utmost speed, which was about 10 knots, which you could run that fast.
Yeah, so you're almost like sitting ducks.
Yeah, well, we were. Yeah. And some of those ships didn't have a, well, the Fairfield City that got bombed right alongside of us, they said, please stay with us, we're unprotected. They had two 50 caliber machine guns, one on one wing, one on the other. It's like throwing potatoes at them, you know. Did no good. So they got sunk. But some of them had some good guns on them, but some of them were unarmed.
Wow.
Anyway, we doubled up. I got permission to brother and I to come back on the same ship, which he did. In fact, it was a British ship, and I've forgotten the name of it. But they brought us back to Glasgow, and we stayed there 2 weeks in a small town, Hamilton, I think it was, outside of Glasgow, and gave us some liberty. Of course, merchant ships, when the ship is sunk or your pay stops because mm-hmm. your job is gone. In the Navy, your money continues, your salary continues. So we actually broke more or less when we got to Scotland. I think the Red Cross gave us some money. Anyway, we doubled up. After 2 weeks, he put us aboard the Queen Mary. About 10,000 troops going back home. And there was only a cabin for two. They put six of us in one cabin. And like the British always do, they always have a sing-song. So it's that, and I had a guitar and mandolin. We had a sing-song. We were asked to play and sing, so we did. So we sang in the main lounge of the Queen Mary, all the crew. Yeah. So, oh, by the way, when we were in Moscow, we made recordings. The gal that taught us the Russian songs had us record, I don't know, about three or four.
Oh, wow.
Hillbilly song, hillbilly. And whether they ever broadcast them on the radio, I don't know. And then when we got to England, Glasgow, they sent a fellow down from the BBC, and we made a couple of records for them. Whether they broadcast or not, we don't know.
But yeah. Anyway. Wow.
So he got aboard ship and second mates. With a licensed second mate, so we both shipped out immediately afterwards. The ship came into Boston. We were originally from Boston, so the folks were there and they met us. Went down to New York and shipped out again. I shipped out as second mate on the African Dawn Feral Lines. At the time, it was the American South African line. Mm-hmm. And stayed aboard her until I got chief mate to time in for chief mate. And then I went on the Liberty ship as chief mate for a year, going to Europe and so on. And then had time in 1944 for a master's license. Got a master's license right off the bat and a 3-day examination for a master's license. And then shipped out as master. Mm. I got married at the same time. I'd met this gal, the nice chief mate, and met her in New York, Brooklyn. Had a date Friday, Saturday. Sunday, she said she had a girlfriend, so I sailed Monday for 6 months from New York around South Africa up through the Red Sea and back. It took 6 months. Came back and we married 2 weeks later, and the marriage lasted 44 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so had four. Everybody says how many. Of course, I was three years running as master to West Africa. And we had about 15 ports down and back. Mm-hmm. So everybody asked me how many kids you got. I said four to speak of.
Yeah, right.
They say, oh, don't you miss the ocean? I said, no, I miss the ports. I know the ocean. There's a wave I saw last trip.
Right, yeah, exactly. Wow. Did you ever keep in contact with any of the other members of the, any of the other survivors of the convoy over the years? Did you?
A couple, maybe, but then it faded. I mean, you don't know. Maybe they died or whatever. Because we spread out. We scattered as soon as we get ashore.
Yeah.
And the crew, of course, and not the officer, but the crew themselves, they'd ship out from the hall and then get a different company or a different ship and so on. So you lost track quickly.
Yeah.
The officers, of course, were usually shipped out. At that time, the companies usually tried to keep the officers aboard ship. So.
Yeah.
But the only problem then, of course, different now, but the only problem then, they give you 2 weeks vacation a year. And being master of the ship, you would, well, if you want to take your two weeks leave, Cap, we'll go ahead, but it's a 3-month trip. you would be off pay a little because you got back, so you ain't couldn't afford it, you know. So, but that before I left, I had three kids, so I couldn't afford a vacation.
Yeah.
When you come back, you'd come back from West Africa, and you'd probably start with New York, so you'd be about 2 days in New York. So you go home, have a grand time for 2 days, and then ship would go to Philadelphia, and then Baltimore, Norfolk, back up the coast to New York and sail. So it wasn't much time at home. Time enough to get the wife impregnated, but each of my kids were about 3 years apart.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm. Being a twin, he says, my brother was married first and he had a boy. Then I got married, then I had a girl. He had a boy, and I had a girl. And he says, I don't want any more of these roughnecks, so he quit. So I had another girl. He says, see what happens? You've got all the girls, I got two boys. So he got down to Panama earlier than I did, about a year and a half. And after six years later, after I got there, guess what? My wife became pregnant.
Oh, wow.
And my brother's left-handed. And a kid was born. In fact, called me from the hospital, Coca-Cola Hospital, about 3 a.m. Your wife just gave birth to a baby boy. You know, there in the States, he wouldn't tell what sex it was or anything. Yeah, she gave birth, but they'll tell you everything on the phone. And I said, you sure you got the right one? So guess what? He grew up, and not only is he left-handed, but he looks like his uncle.
Really? Wow. Strong family resemblance.
Sure he would, because I'm a twin. You know? So we both look. I mean, my twin brother's a good-looking fella, and you can't tell us apart.
Yeah, okay.
But anyway, I tell that at a party, you know. Yeah, I had all the girls, and then we got down together here, and all of a sudden my wife gets a boy. My wife would laugh like hell, because she knew differently.
Yeah.
But his wife, she didn't think that was funny at all. Anyway, another joke.
Yeah, that's funny.
And he now is president of this outfit.
Uh-huh. Of the society.
Yeah, society. Tom Weiler.
Wow. That must have been something. I mean, you must have had a lot of stories to tell each other about the convoy and the war and...
Yep. Yeah. We're quite fortunate it didn't get killed.
Yeah.
You know? That wasn't the only time we got shot at. We were attacked on the east coast of Africa going to the Indian Ocean. Attacked by a submarine, we're heading in convoy, heading north to the Red Sea. And we put nets over, I was chief mate on the Liberty ship. And we put anti-submarine nets or something on each side, put them over the booms, dragged them when there was an idea of the submarine around. And on the ship, brought the nets aboard, and if he didn't have his torpedo lodged in the net, it hadn't exploded. So he got to the Red Sea, and the Navy came aboard, and Navy ordnance, whatever it was, and he took the submarine and gave him a receipt for it. So that was a receipt of one German torpedo delivered to the Navy. That was pretty good.
Well, life as a pilot and on the canal, it sounds like it may have been a little less dramatic.
No, it was more.
It was more dramatic. Okay.
Sure, every transit was dramatic because entering the locks, you didn't know whether you gotta whack them or not. You know, you gotta. The difference in the pilotage in Panama than any other place, Boston, Baltimore, anything. Pilot comes aboard at the sea buoy at most ports, and he just says, okay, full ahead, no slow or whatever. There's no time limit. He can do it for 2 hours, or he can make it an hour. He can get an hour, staying in the speed limit, of course. In the Panama Canal, especially southbound, you they called you. In fact, we had chauffeur-driven cars to pick us up at the house and deliver us either to the boathouse or to a pier to take a ship. And you were given a time to be at Gatun. Now, you better make that time. If you're 5 minutes late, they call you on the phone and say, what's the matter with you? You got a 700-foot ship. Now, that's three football fields or whatever.
Yeah.
You got to make sure that you get there on time. Otherwise, the locks are idle and wasting time.
Yeah.
And the companies are, you're holding back a whole pile of ships and so on. So you schedule, you have to maintain it. Maybe you can pick up a couple of minutes. Brother and I always did. Anyway, in fact, I got to the cut one time at night, about 6 o'clock at night, I guess it was. And I passed Gamboa. You take your time at Gamboa going through the cut 7 mile thing that they dug through the rocks and to Peter McGill Locks. And I passed Gamboa. I'm approaching Cucaracha Bend anyway. And I heard the dispatcher call the ship and spin to me. He says, You're Gamboa time, you know, crap, but don't forget you're following Wilder. In other words, the locks will be waiting for him. So, hey, nice compliment. But brother and I always try to make gain time. A lot of them just drifted and sometimes they were late here and there and everywhere. They called down about it, but we had to make a skip. We had to make it a certain time to be there, and we had to be there. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you rode with somebody, a senior pilot, for the first three months, and then you were let loose on a yacht or something. And then you get 350 feet, I guess it was the first limit, and it went up to, well, the biggest ones are 950 feet long ships, which is called Panamax size. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest it'll fit right now. Of course, they're building them bigger now, but the new set of locks won't be ready for another 10 years. Won't take that long. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's more or less. But every time you approach the any of the locks, 110 feet, and you got a 70-foot beam, so you only got, 20 or... Well, figure it out on either side, 110 foot wide, and you go 70 feet. So that's 40, you're 20 feet on either side if you're in the middle.
Yeah.
And if you've got a single screw ship turbine, you have to wait for the moment, for the thing to build up what you want, speed you want, or stop, same thing. It takes a while to stop the damn turbine, and she will drift, and you figure she's in ballast and the wind blowing one way or the other. So it's quite a job to get in and out of a lock without hitting anything. Mm-hmm. But, the fellow says a successful transit is no matter how you did it, you didn't touch anything. No matter what you did, you didn't touch anything.
How on earth could you do that though with all of the...
After a while, I put... without counting ships that they used to take, they sometimes they have a shuttle, or you'd have a watch, an 8-hour watch, more or less, kind of how long it took you. You'd lock up two ships or lock down two ships at Gatun, and then you'd go home. And I didn't count those, but I did count all my transits, and I kept a record of them. I made 2,554 transits.
Wow.
Period of about 30 years.
Uh-huh.
But you got to, you know, there was a certain type. You got to know practically every ship, because a Liberty ship, you knew that everything was full ahead or full astern, you know, real rough with them.
Yeah.
A motor ship, you couldn't do that because they were really sensitive. You put it on half a head and you really get the thing going at half a head. The motor starts quickly. Mm-hmm. So you didn't have to wait too long for your maneuver. But, and then you had to slow it down the at that time, years ago, they only had the old locomotives with one single wire. And if you got over to, they towed it two notch, which is about as they used to have men walking on the side wall and side wall with lines in case the locomotive failed or something. They could put a line out and make it fast to a bollard before you hit the concrete.
Yeah.
And you'd come in, and if you overran your locomotive, there's no use to you. So you had to get speed of two knots or less, but you had to keep it coming. And and if you kicked it too much, you got over speed. If you didn't kick her enough, she's beginning to set one way or the other. She won't steer at two knots, you know. So jeepers, I mean, you got to figure that when you're going into a lock or leaving. And you get some of these big Panamax size ships or 600 foot ships, say, with 100 extreme beamers that you could go through is 106 feet. Another, you got 2 feet on either side.
Yeah.
2 feet on either side of a 700 foot ship, and you're looking down the side. As soon as you see daylight disappear, you tell that locomotive to tow, stop towing here, and so on, or brake, or whatever. And get to them. There's no place for the water to go. It's all confined, you know. You can't squeeze water. It won't compress. And yeah. There's three chambers. You come in the lower chamber. That's not too bad. Of course, you got a current coming out because the salt water and fresh water mix on the surface about 10 feet down. And from there on, it might be slack or whatever. Of course, the ship's drawn 36 feet. So you gotta figure on that. Yeah. So anyway, you come in, you make the damnedest maneuver, you know, to a first skipper transit, you know. He's nervous, and when he sees you heading for the sidewall and then bringing her in this way towards the center, he's wondering what the heck is he doing, you know. But you have to do that to stem the current. If you can't do that, you'll either hit the sidewall or you're going to hit the center wall. Anyway, you get one of these big ones. There's no sense to trying to get smart with them. Just get her up against the wood, as they call it, on the center wall, and slide her in. Well, she wants to go off. Her stern wants to go off and hit that knuckle over there. But you got the stern locomotive fine, so you brake on him. You brake him. So you finally get in the lower chamber. And now you got to watch her when they give the water, because there's a lot of turbulence. She may set one side or the other. They give you water on both sides. Well, if there's another ship that's got double culvert, you only get one side. So she's going to set the other way. And well, anyway, that's half the battle. So you get up going into the middle chamber. Well, everything's fine, all the water's still. But you're going from deep water into a shallow water. In other words, so what you do, you're coming in and you got a ship on a half a head. She's drawing 36 or 39 feet, whichever. And she begins to slow down when you got her on half a head. At half a head at sea on the ship, it would say she'd be doing 10 knots. But right now you're only doing about 2.5. So anyway, she's slowing down. So I do it on Jap ships a lot. Japanese had a lot of bulk carriers. They're 900 foot long. They got 1.25 inch plating for about 800 feet. A battleship, forget it. A battleship is tapered. So the extreme beam is 109 feet. But it's armor plating about 40 feet. So that bangs against the wall, you don't care. You know? But 1.25 inches, you're gonna get a dent or a hole.
Yeah.
So you gotta watch it, and then it's about 700 feet of that is 1.25 inch plate until the bow comes around. So you're pushing her in, and she's on half a head. The old man's standing on the wing with you, and you're watching, you see her slowing down. And you casually say, "Put her on full, Captain, full ahead." Pilot, the pilot, the gates, It's all right, Captain. Put her on full. So you put her on full. And you could see the water going up on the gate like this, because there's no place for it to go on the side, see, or the bottom. So it goes up about 3 or 4 feet on the gate. And then the ship will come up, and by God, you're going full ahead. And she begins to go back. She goes back about 20 feet. And then she's charged. When she's going back about 20 feet, you say to the old man, "Hey, Cap, you got sea speed?" Now, the sea speed is all you got full ahead. God, the old man's about to pull his hair out. The gates, the gates. Now, we never hit him, Cap. And you chuckle to yourself. It's all even, pressure's all even, but there's no place for the water to go, you know. So the man is going down the sides and underneath, you know, going like hell, you know, even out. A lot of fun. Going down the cut, I have 7 miles of cut where they dug. The rest is flooded. You got to make go down the cut, and you can't get out. You can't get out of the channel. You've hit the rock first. Yeah. On either side. I had a Navy ship one time, and we lost the plan. In other words, something went wrong down below, and everything stopped. And she's heading for the bank. The old man says, "Pilot, I said, let go of 2 anchors." He says, "What's that?" I said, "Well, that's rock. You know, you don't want to hit it."
Yeah.
Yeah, if it's sand, yeah, fine. Suez, sand, you got sand on either side.
And the Suez Canal.
But not Panama. Panama is rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever have a incident where the ship did hit the side? And
They've sunk them. In fact, just lately, the ship leave coming in, I guess it was, coming in, and she lost the plane right under the bridge and hit one of the, it drove ashore right by the bridge. Must have hit the, whatever it is they put for the bridge structure to go down to the bedrock or something.
Uh-huh.
She was this crossways, 700-foot ship.
Mm.
That's good size to get crossways. But she lost the plane, according to the paper.
Yeah.
But anytime there's you figure they put about 13,000 ships through a year.
Yeah.
That's not counting a little yacht or something. That's mm-hmm. counting anything over 300 foot.
Yeah.
And you figure 1%, they have an accident. 1% of 13,000 is what, 130 ships,
yeah.
more or less? Something like that.
Yeah.
But it's only about 1%.
Wow.
They do have accidents. And it's never what was the name of the ship. It's who's the pilot?
Yeah.
It's all, who's the pilot?
Uh-huh.
Yep. When the old man takes it, when the old man brings the ship in, poor guy, he's going to watch his pilot, because the pilot is experienced.
Yeah.
But you never know, you know, you make mistakes, but the old man, it's his ship, but he better not interfere, because you can put him ashore. As a pilot of the Panama Canal, it's the only place in the world, except going into a dry dock, where the pilot is solely in charge of the navigation of the vessel. The skipper stands by and is a witness to any accident, but he can't take over.
Hmm.
If he does, he's put ashore.
Wow.
Take a train over, pick the ship out on the other side, Cap.
Did you ever have to do that?
Huh? I never had to, no. Uh-huh. I was going along with skippers.
Uh-huh.
But I've had some nervous ones.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Get all types for over 2,000 ships. You get
type.
You get a lot of ships over here, especially me. Where, oh, I see you're back, pilot. And I know what's happening. Brother had it. Never been here before. Huh. I had a guy on the Graceline, mate. What are you talking about? You were here last trip. I said, not me. Well, your name's Wilder, isn't it? Yep. Well, you were here last trip, says so in the logbook. Look at the initials. Yeah, A. Wilder. Look at mine. A. Wilder. You know, what's the middle initial? L. What's that one? T. Oh, you must be twins. We are. As a matter of fact, going into Gatun on the big ones, the bridge is usually even with the control house, which is on the upper level. And the control house operator is the guy that opens the gates and so on after the lock master tells them to open them, close uh-huh. them. So when he has nothing to do and the ship's going into the upper chamber, the bridge is just about even with the we got a balcony there. And the control house operator usually comes out and talks to the old skipper if he knows, talks to the pilot if he knows him. You're watching the sidewall and working your locomotives. And he'd come out and he's only off from here to the wall, away from you. So this one, Robbie Erickson, very astute gentleman, pilot, good friend, good pilot. Anyway, the control house operator says, "Hi, Captain Robinson." And Robbie says, "Yeah, how's it going?" "Pretty good. Hey, by the way," he says, "they're working the hell out of Wilder." We had about 300 pilots when I was there when I left. Before I got there, and when I got there, there was about 75, but they got up to 300. Anyway, he said, "They're working the hell out of Wilder." Robbie says, very blankly, "What do you mean?" "Well, see that ship that just went, just cleared and going over to anchor? He's on the ship coming up here." Robbie says, "They're twins." "I got twins? I never knew that."
You just thought you were been, pretty hard
been
worker.
"Been there for 3 years. My brother's been there for five." Twins.
They wonder how you could be in two places at one time.
Well, I went aboard this grace boat. And of course, the guy pulled out the logbook. It was different initials, He was willing to bet that I'd been there before.
How did you communicate with the locomotive? Walkie-talkie?
First, when we got there, it was all hands. They call it a silent lockage. This was tow. This was point. Bring the locomotive back to brake. Stop braking, so on.
Okay.
The locomotive always watched you, supposedly, and they couldn't talk to you. You could talk to them, but they had to listen. They couldn't talk to you.
There are locomotives on either side or one?
Well, most ships, the average side had six locomotives, two forward, two mid, two is a sort of a string line to bring the bow one way. You can control the stern with a rudder. In an engine, but you can't control the bow. So with the four locomotives forward, you're towing on one, towing on four, and you bring these two back to brake, and still have tight wires on the four, so the bow won't flop around. And when you brake, you brake them with these four locomotives, or you can bring the bow locomotives back and brake with six. But usually just brake with four and send these forward ahead. The two are always braking back out. They're always in a braking position. They can't tow. And the two forward ones you can use to tow, two middle ones used to tow or brake, but you don't want to rig them forward, not midships, because it'll pull the thing over bodily. So you use them forward to control the bow. But now they got the new locomotives and they're simpler to handle. They got two wires. And you can just put two forward and two aft.
What types of changes did you see as a pilot over your 3 decades of service? Did things change much in terms of the technology?
Very slow. Mostly the job is the same as far as the locks are concerned. Of course, they're dredging all the time, especially the cut, and a little bit in the lake, not much, but mostly in the cut where you have slides in the cut. It's like a grain hills of grain, you get too steep a thing and it just flows in, so dredging all the time in the cut.
Did you have I've heard a couple folks talk about Pilots Association.
Oh yeah.
Was that the that and that was your association?
Yeah, the Panama Canal Pilots Association. I was president at one time, 1972, I think it was.
Okay.
But you couldn't do much because it was a government job.
Yeah.
You couldn't strike, but you could slow down. And we did slow down one time.
Oh, wow.
There were about 100 ships anchored outside.
Uh-huh.
We were doing our job because the job said, this is how you did it. You brought it in, you tied it up to the center wall, and then you waited, then you put your locomotives on, and then you moved up and picked up your sidewall, and with that you went in under locomotive speed so they could have traction. And when you got up there, you waited until the gates opened and recessed before you towed again. And man, that takes time. So what you do is you come in, you pick your locomotives up on the fly, you know, and then you get in as soon as you tow. If it's a small ship, you keep going in until you watch the lock master won't give you the water until the gates close, naturally. So you look aft, when you see the gates close, you quickly break, get the ship still in the water, and it gives you the water. And when you gates, you see them crack, it's all gravity, there's no pumps. It's all gravity, so when the water from the upper chamber comes down the lower chamber, and it's such a speed that it builds up about a two inch high level on this side. The chamber you're filling, then the other one that you're emptying, and it'll crack the gate. Because the motor that operates the gate's only about 40 horsepower. Mm-hmm. And when they look out and see the gates crack, in other words, the locks are, the gates are floating now. So very little resistance. So that's when they start to open. And you're not supposed to totally get set inside the walls. But you can time it so that, in other words, you don't want to have a wire hang up at a halfway open gate. Mm-hmm. So you can time it so that when she just recessed, the wires from the locomotive are right there. You didn't waste a second.
Didn't waste a second. Well, and what was the, when you said you slowed down, what was that over an issue involving workload or
no? You see, we always had a contention with the governor or the marine director. Our wage couldn't be over more than the directors of the company or the governor, of course. So our wages are kept below them, but we were the highest paid employees of the canal, aside of the governor and the directors. So we'd like to add more. Every other pilot in any port in the United States earned twice as much as we were getting. And their job is to get the ship, no time schedule, just get it in there. There's no stopping, they're starting most. Sometimes they go to anchor, sometimes they go alongside the pier. And there was no time set. You sent the pilot out and he got aboard and took the ship in. That was his job. North of Virginia, they used two pilots. They used the sea pilot come in off the pier, tugboat skipper would come aboard, he was a docking pilot. And the guy that brought it in from sea just sat back, waited for the gangway to go ashore. So the job was finished.
Mm-hmm.
South of Norfolk, I guess it was. He did his own docking too, but north of Piers they didn't. They used a docking pilot.
Okay.
But there's no time schedule or anything. Pilot went aboard. When he got there, took ship in. Not much. But there in Gatun, the ship would say they were 5 minutes late going into Gatun, and the next ship maybe 10 minutes late. So now the third ship, he's about 15 minutes or 20 minutes behind schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll still get his ship in there, but he'll still be late.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So yeah, it was pretty stressful job.
It was.
Well, did anything come out of the slowdown? Did
oh no, I forgot how at that time they fired the. I wasn't president at the time, but they fired the president of the Pot Association, as well as the two other fellows. Forgotten who they were, but they hired him back the next day.
So they retaliated against you guys, and
they were groaning and moaning, you know. You called in sick, you know, and you don't want a sick pilot out there, you know.
Exactly. What year did you retire, Captain Wilder?
1980. Wait a minute. Let me think. Yeah, 1980. But I went back in 82, in January, 82, for another year, because they found out that too many senior pilots had retired. They were running out of pilots, so you could go back for... 62 was the cutoff date, in other words. I come home one time, my wife says, "Oh, you're retired." I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "I just finished filling your papers out and sent them back in. You're retired." I said, "Geez, thanks a lot." So anyway, that's how it happened. I retired.
That's when you reached 62.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was it. But then 2 years later, I met an assistant port captain. What the hell was I? I guess I was in North Carolina at the time. And one of, you know, how are they doing? Yeah, they're looking for pilots. Oh, put my name in. Oh, you want to go back? Sure. So I went back and worked for another year.
Uh-huh.
So total, I'm about 30 years.
Okay.
Yeah. But I would never left if it hadn't been mandatory retirement.
Yeah.
Because even in my day, there was some that couldn't or didn't want to do the job in the canal, so they made them assistant port captains, and they got the same pay, and went out and read drafts to make sure the ship went over draft, and they sat in on investigations when the ship had an accident and so on, so you didn't have to go aboard the ship, you could stay there till you're 100.
Hmm.
Of course, if you're going through the canal, it meant climbing a ladder, going down a ladder, whatever. Sometimes a gangway, not often, but sometimes a gangway, mostly a pile ladder. I remember took a friend of mine I grew up with in high school. He came down to visit me. So he wanted to make a transit. I said, "Yeah, come on with me." So we got a Maersk boat. Well, a Maersk boat is about 600 and some odd feet. She got a freeboard of about 30 feet, looked like anyway, you know, high. Canal crew came aboard, you know, with Balboa, and they're supposed to get off in the basin, which is smooth water. And he's looking at Oscar, his name was. Oscar's looking at the boat and saying, "Geez, look at that." I said, "Yeah, see him? You think he can do that? Well, do you think you can do it when you get out in the sea?" "Well, Alton, yeah, that's what you're going to be doing." So what I did, I got on the ladder first. I said, "Come on." So he got on between me and the ladder, see, and we went down that way. And then, of course, I stepped out of the boat. And I told him, I said, "If you don't make it in one jump, make it in two." I grabbed his arm and pulled him.
Uh-huh.
And another brother, my brother-in-law, went through one time. And he's smart as hell, you know, young fella. So he come down the ladder, and instead of putting his hand on the pilot launch, he puts his hand on the ship. I said, "Leave that." I said, "Get your hand off of that. That thing's leaving."
Yeah, it's moving.
And you have a lot of fun.
Wow. Well, Captain Wilder, I know you have a lot of things to do at the reunion, and we spent about an hour. I really appreciate your time.
I can go on forever.
Well, I was going to ask you if you had any other stories that you hadn't had a chance to talk about. Or you?
Well, I had a few accidents.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. One was, I'll never forget the name of the ship, the Himimactra. She was a shell tanker, 555 feet long, turbine loaded. And I'm clearing the locks of Miraflores, and she's drawing about 36 feet. So she's deep, turbine, slow thing, low water. I didn't even know, you know, you say, yeah, low water, okay, I'll handle it. But then you don't, you forget that when somebody calls you on the radio and says, hey, Ab, they call me Ab. My twin brother couldn't pronounce Albert. He went from Abbott to Ab. Anyway, they call me Ab and said, Ab, I'll hold the jitney for you if you're going to show up before 6:30. Well, it's about quarter of six now. So I said, okay, full ahead. Oh, what a mistake. So I'm going to Pier 18. You can take bunkers. So I'm down. And well, I'm getting up to about 10 knots now. And the pier's coming in sight. And the skipper says, where are we going, pilot? And I said, right over there. I'm sure he's wondering. You know, so I put it back on slow ahead and round in the basin. When a ship is in shoal water, she tends to take a bigger circle than pressure, water pressure and so on, tends to make a bigger circle as she curves around. Well, Pier 18 and Balboa is heading this way. We have docks here, 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 and here. And I'm going on this side. So I come around, oh my. I'm saying to myself, and they send out a 1,500 horsepower tug, and I'm looking for a 2,000 horsepower tug, you know. So anyway, you come around, and she's coming around. I said, full astern, stand by two anchors, and I finally got the anchors down, and she's still coming, and she's still coming. I'm watching, and the pier. End of the pier disappears under the bow.
You know, oh no.
And blump. And there she is. God, it made a mess of that bow. It didn't disturb the bed of the winch forward that heaves the anchors and you make fast with it with the lines. Uh-huh. But it didn't disturb the bed of the winch. But it sure made hell out of the bow, the stem. Anyway, and put a big knot in the concrete pier at the end of it. Ah, geez. So she, I ended up alongside the end of it like this and finally got her around. And the next day, they put me on Doran's vial. I was 2 months, no, I guess it was a month, maybe longer, but as dock foreman. No loss of pay. Uh-huh. I'd report to the office at 8 o'clock in the morning and direct ships there. You want to tie, you know, I want your bow here, Cap, or your bridge here, and so on, in Cristobal. I worked uh-huh. there for about a month before they let me back in the canal. But one British skipper going past the ship when it was alongside, discharging its oil that I think is loaded with, not gasoline, but oil. Anyway, there's just charging along inside another ship. You can see the bow from the canal. the British skipper says to the pilots that are going by, he said, my God, pilot, sure knocked the hell out of that bow of that ship. What happened? Oh, he's coming around too fast, he says, and hit the end of the pier. See where the notch on the pier is? He says, well, he said, just looks like he never lost a drop of cargo, and I didn't.
Right.
Because hit it on the side, she'd have leaked oil, you know. Yeah. It ran out, just fresh water.
What'd the skipper say?
That's it. Well, the skipper was on the ship I was on. He was upset a bit. He says, I'll see you tomorrow, Captain, investigation. And I did.
Uh-huh.
But that was the worst one I had.
Well, shoot, out of over 2,500.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
Oh, yeah. Less than 1%.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Hmm. Did you pilot after you retired anywhere, any other port or?
Pilotage is local knowledge.
Okay.
In other words, I'm not qualified to pilot any place else because I don't know the port.
Okay.
Pilotage is local knowledge.
Local knowledge.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's one reason, you know, they put a pilot aboard because the old man coming from sea, everything looks awful narrow.
Yeah.
And so on. So I always have a pilot, or most ports do. I know West Africa, in Luanda, excuse me, Angola, Lobito and Luanda, they didn't have a pilot. But they had some nice concrete docks and you could dock alongside. Mm-hmm. And for a young fella, I went skipper at 26 years old, and a young fella, you take a lot of chances, and you don't know what you're doing, but you hope you don't sink the ship. And I managed to put it alongside the piers. I didn't know how to do it, but after 30 years in Panama, I know how.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I always tried to dock it without you. Going alongside any of the piers, any size ship, you always had a tug, mm-hmm. or two. If you're going alongside the starboard side of the pier, when you back a single screw, the stern will really walk away from the pier, especially if ship's loaded. And you usually ask for two tugs if she's turbine or whatever, but on port side too, she'll back into the pier, or the stern will fall into the pier, kind of rotation of the propeller, and you use just one tug. But I tried to, every docking I ever did, I had to try to use it without using the tug. Tug was alongside, charged to the vessel, but I wouldn't use them. Mm-hmm. Or try not to. I'd use them a little more engine movements on the ship, but it didn't cost anything. Mm-hmm. I tried to get in there without figuring that what happens if the tug loses its power or breaks parts of the line, which happens. You're doing it without the tug. You're trying to put it in without the tug, so you're not exactly at a loss. But if you try to push her in, I've seen a lot of them get alongside at about 20 feet off and push the whole thing in. What if the tug isn't there? Or what if he's lost his power or something? You're out the middle of the stream crashing, you know, without a paddle.
Yeah. Shoot.
I went from there, after retiring, I went from there to the Maritime Institute in Lincoln, which is in Virginia. And I was instructing in ship handling on two simulators that I had there.
Okay.
I had there. So I was 16 years working that after I left the canal.
Okay.
And it was the same thing, but simulated work. And I used to have fun, you know, when the class wasn't there to work a ship from where I was sitting in the control room and work a ship alongside a pier. I'll speed in and back the hell out of it and so on. A lot of fun.
Did you ever go back to Panama?
Yeah, wife died after 44 years of marriage. Her wife died, and we took her ashes and I went down in 91 and spread her ashes in Limon Bay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we won a prize last year from society here, wife and I, so second wife. So we went down for 4 days on the free. We're supposed to stay at a hotel up at Coronado, but it was for young people. So I have three daughters that I took down in 52, mm-hmm. and they're still there.
Wow.
So we stayed with them rather than a hotel. Had a fine time.
Wow.
Didn't recognize a damn thing ashore. I knew the canal, I could see it. You know, but
a lot of things have changed.
Oh, and man, I'll say. We were in Coca-Cola or someplace. It sure didn't look like Coca-Cola to me. Yeah, everything has changed down there now. They built buildings and made roads, improvement. Mm-hmm. And, hope to continue.
Yeah.
But as far as giving the Pan Canal away, it always burns me when somebody says, well, we gave it back to them. They never had it. we built the canal. We established Panama as a country. We built the canal, and then we gave it to them. We gave them the docks. We gave them the buildings. We gave them everything that's there. And they even moved the graves out of the cemeteries. People who died there and their relatives wanted the graves removed. We moved it at our expense, not the Panamanian expense or anything. When we gave it to them, they didn't get it back. We gave it to them. They didn't have it to start with. And don't you forget it. But, yeah, great place. Things were so, you know, that it was hard to fire you unless you did something really rotten, such as murder, or somebody accused you of taking his wife or something. But outside of that, it's pretty tough to fire. It's a government job, so they give you a slap on the wrist. But outside of that, you're pretty secure in your job. And a good place to raise kids.
Well, Captain Wilder, thank you so much for taking time to do the interview. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I enjoy it.
All right.
With my twin brother, anything over 80-foot beam that put two pilots on, you split the thing, you know. One guy go to gamble and the other guy take from there. First and second half, they call it. But anyway, got aboard this Italian tanker, about 600 foot. Going halfway through the lake, I had the first half. My brother was standing outside the wing, enjoying the sunshine and so on. And the skipper had to come up from the bridge and look and says, "Mr. Pilot." I said, "Yes, Captain. Is that your brother out there?" I says, no relation to him. Oh, I make a mistake. Yeah, I guess so. A year later, he's coming in, same ship. I hadn't forgotten about it. And I go aboard. He's going to go to the pier, so I got a dock, put him alongside. Pier 18, Pier 19. He looks at me and says, "Oh, hello, pilot. How's your brother?" "Oh, fine, Cap." We're full of him a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny.